investment bank Goldman Sachs goes public.
Public with some details about how it makes its money.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, January the 11th. Coming up, Japan has thrown a bailout lifeline to Europe. Also, you can ride the quiet car near Chicago. And where those tweets come from. The words tell a story. We'll find out about it a little later.
But first, the investment bank Goldman Sachs today is expected to announce more than three dozen changes that's going to affect how it discloses to clients, how it makes a profit. Why would the ultra-secret Wall Street institution do such a thing? Marketplace's John Dimsdale is with us from our Washington studio with the latest. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Steve.
What are these accounting changes we're talking about here?
Well, Goldman's going to start separating out the earnings from trading and investing its own money versus how much it makes from investing clients' money. Remember, Goldman got in trouble with regulators for selling mortgage loans that were almost certain to fail. And in fact, Goldman was betting its own money that they would fail. Goldman settled that government lawsuit last summer for $550 million for misleading clients. There's also going to be new conflict of interest rules that will require more disclosure of how Goldman bets its own money, and the power of Goldman's trading desks, which put together these toxic assets that were sold to the public as investments, is going to be reined in.
So how much, John, is this about Goldman trying to clean up its reputation?
Well, there is a lot of public relations in today's announcement, but there may be a bit more. Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics says separating the accounting of its own trading from trading other people's money is also Goldman's way of complying with new financial regulatory rules passed by Congress last year.
They arguably have to break that out anyway because the law prohibits them from doing proprietary own account trading. This is making a virtue out of a necessity.
So we'll find out a lot more about Goldman's finances with their next annual report, and that comes out at the end of this month.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. John, thanks.
You're welcome.
For some more perspective on this story, let's get some analysis from our Tuesday regular, Julie Neiman. She's an analyst with Smith Moore & Company, and she's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So why is Goldman doing this, and what are we going to learn from it?
At last, we see the voodoo they do so well. There's always been a question whether it's black magic or black box. What we will get is divisional breakout. Where's the profit coming from? But this is normal in compliance with Regulation FD, full and fair disclosure. That's about 10 years ago. The big question is, though, disclosure doesn't equal change. Change comes when you remove the profit from an activity, and all they're doing is moving out proprietary trading. That's going to be a subdivision of the company.
All right, Julie, and quickly, big picture here, you know, 2.5 years after the financial crisis, do we really know much more about what the big banks are doing?
Not really, because it's almost like doing an autopsy on the dead banks. We know the cause of death here. We know exactly what it was. It was bad lending. But Dr. Volcker was fired before he could do the cure. You can't bet the house when you're gambling, trading for profits. Banks are going to give part of that up. But we still aren't addressing the lousy lending standards, the operational deficiencies. That's the foreclosure fraud that was going on. Capital deficiencies, not enough cushion to weather the downturn. And Dr. Volcker was working on the cure, so I don't see much meaningful change at all.
Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. Thanks as always.
You bet.
Today, the President's Oil Spill Commission officially releases its report on the BP oil spill. Meanwhile, the oil industry's trade group, the American Petroleum Institute, has been rolling out a new ad campaign in Washington, D.C., touting all the jobs the oil industry creates. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill looks at how an ad campaign like this could affect regulation of oil companies.
Do ads about an industry's economic importance really grab people's attention? USC professor Ira Kalb says probably not.
I don't think these ads that I'm looking at are going to really do it. Because, again, people are going to tune it out. We've heard it before and we don't believe it. It's got a credibility problem.
Kalb says we're exposed to an average of 20,000 ads a week. Those that don't stand out don't stand a chance. But Marissa Gluck from Radar Research says the ads are more about oil industry playing defense than anything else.
Even if they're, even if they're coming under attack for environmental, economic, and social disruptions, they can always point to job creation.
And she says this ad campaign is targeting politicians who made a whole lot of job growth promises they now need to deliver on. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, the 11th day of January. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now, the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
It is a deepening debt crisis across the pond in Europe, as we know. First Greece, then Ireland. Now the Japanese government has pledged about $1 billion to help out with an Irish bailout. Marketplace's Europe correspondent Stephen Beard is with us from London with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Is this a direct investment, a direct Japanese investment in Ireland?
No, they're buying some of these so-called bailout bonds. The money will go to Ireland as part of its bailout, but the bonds will be guaranteed by the whole of the European Union. So the money is pretty safe.
And what's at stake for the Japanese, Stephen?
Well, quite a bit. I mean, 10% of Japanese exports go to the EU, so it has an interest, Japan has an interest in trying to prevent turmoil in that market. Also, of course, if the Eurozone were to break up, the Euro would collapse and other stronger currencies, especially the Japanese yen, would soar, and that would make Japanese exports more expensive and be bad for Japanese business.
Is this investment, Stephen, going to prevent the European debt crisis from getting bigger, from spreading?
Well, one analyst I've been talking to this morning says no. Steve Barrow of Standard Bank says Greece and Ireland have already fallen and had to be bailed out. Barrow thinks Portugal could be the next casualty.
It does look as if Portugal, for instance, is the next domino to fall. And I don't think Japanese investment in the Eurozone will stop Portugal from requiring that bailout.
The Portuguese Prime Minister has just this morning denied again that Portugal does need bailing out. We'll find out whether that's true when his government tries to borrow more money on the markets tomorrow.
Stephen Beard, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
China's largest oil and gas producer has struck a deal with a British energy company, and that's going to give China a stake in one of Britain's key oil refineries in Scotland and another in France. But why is a Chinese company interested in these operations? The BBC's Rebecca Singer has that.
For PetroChina, this joint venture is about expanding to become a truly global company. And striking a deal with Britain's INEOS gives it unprecedented access to Western European markets. Questions have been asked about whether China will use the oil for its own purposes. But Tom Crotty, one of the directors of the INEOS group, says China doesn't need the oil.
If they wanted it for their own needs, they'd be spending the money building refineries in China. This is very much about building a strategic long-term business. It helps us develop our strategy in Asia because we're going to be doing more work there with them as well.
Crotty says PetroChina will invest in the two European refineries to make them more competitive. And apart from oil refining, PetroChina will also get access to Scottish energy research, which is considered to be amongst the best in the world. China has already secured another deal to develop renewable energy technology pioneered in Scotland. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Over in Chicago, the commuter rail service Metra is going to follow in the tracks of the busy trains where you are, Jeremy, in the Northeast.
That's right, the Northeast Corridor. And as of yesterday, some of the train cars in Chicago will be quiet cars during rush hour,
wow.
Cars you can't talk in. Well, Steve, as someone who occasionally takes the Amtrak's quiet car either to Boston or D.C., I can tell you from experience, those quiet cars are all talk. You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, January 11th. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
The CEO of Barclays Bank was on the hot seat in London this morning, taking flack from lawmakers over his multi-million dollar bonus. Well, whether or not big bank bonuses make you angry, they sure do worry some macroeconomists who are concerned about the rich getting richer while the poor get poorer. World Bank economist Branko Milanovic has just written a new book. It's called The Haves and the Have-Nots. He joins us now from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the United States. You write that income inequality here in the U.S. reached its trough in the late 70s, but has been climbing ever since then. Why is that happening?
There has been a change in technological progress, which actually puts much greater emphasis on high level of skills and ability of people to work with very expensive capital. So the premium for skills has risen, and consequently, the gap between those who have skills and those who don't has increased.
you might say that the countries that don't have as big of a problem with income inequality are communist countries like China. But you write that economic leveling, as you call it, leads to stagnation and ultimate decline, that it's not so great to have perfect equality across the board.
Inequality is like cholesterol. I mean, you have good inequality. That would be inequality which would lead people to take risks, to actually work harder, to study more in order to make more money. But there is also bad inequality. That's inequality which actually cements the acquired position, which doesn't let poor people acquire education if they don't have money and so on.
As you've been writing this book, you've obviously spent a lot of time focusing on income inequality. As you look at the United States, what do you see for us going forward? Are we going to become more unequal when it comes to income or less?
I actually believe that the U.S. has now reached a point where actually it has to go down in terms of income inequality. It would tend to reduce top incomes.
Rich people are not getting richer. They're getting a little bit poorer.
Yes. Of course, poor people, also people who are unemployed, get poorer as well. So it's not an ambiguous thing. But on balance, I think actually the crisis tend to actually reduce slightly inequality.
Branko Milanovic is the author of the new book, The Haves and the Have-Nots, about income inequality. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Congress, of course, has suspended work this week after the shooting tragedy in Arizona. But when members reconvene, one of the first things they're going to have to deal with is how the country will go forward paying for big transportation and infrastructure projects. Budget cuts are on the agenda, and some groups say the private sector can play a bigger role, too. From the Transportation Nation Reporting Project at WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
In Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, not too long ago, I had a conversation with resident Debbie Horoshuk about whether she thought the government should be spending money on things like roads, bridges, and railroads.
It should all be fixed.
You think that would be a good thing to spend money on?
No.
No.
But they should be fixed.
Construction company executives aren't laughing, though. Mike McNally is the president and CEO of Skanska USA. Here's how he describes what it's like to build a huge piece of infrastructure.
You know, start, stop, start, stop.
That's what happened in New Jersey when a Democratic governor started a $9 billion commuter rail tunnel under the Hudson River. A year and a half later, his Republican successor killed the project, saying he was afraid of cost overruns. McNally says it's time to do things differently. Instead of having the government pay, draw up a contract with a private construction firm, let it design, build, and run the project. In exchange, that company gets to collect any revenue the project produces.
It's the most fair way to do it when you think about it, because the person that's using that, say, bridge or tunnel or whatever, is actually paying for the use, not somebody in Nevada.
McNally says many Asian, European, and South American countries won't build any big projects without these partnerships. There are critics. The U.S. Public Interest Research Group's Phineas Baxendahl says they're not really happy marriages.
They're often more like shotgun weddings, where desperate state or city is forced to accept some kind of upfront local cash in order to give a long-term concession.
But still, public-private partnerships are winning converts. The U.S. Transportation Department is getting behind them, and so is the new Republican chair of Congress's Transportation Committee. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, not every publication sees news the same way. If you check the satirical website of The Onion today, one of the top stories has this headline, quote, "Snowy conditions proving hazardous for nation's idiots," unquote.
Oh, that's harsh.
Well, they spoke with this fictional driver who got into a bit of a fender bender.
It was too cold to scrape off the windshield, and I really wanted a super slush. I don't know what else I was supposed to do.
Well, The Onion is launching a sports satire TV show tonight on Comedy Central right before The Daily Show. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins looks at how The Onion might fare on the air.
Think ESPN Sports Center, but with an Onion twist.
Sports Dome is coming your way, and you won't even believe all the sports we've gotten here.
We've got baseball, we've got football, and I'm totally blanking on the other sports.
Along with Sports Dome, The Onion's launching a news parody show on another channel next week. The Onion brings in over 7 million online visitors a month. Its print circulation has suffered, though, as waning ad revenue forced it to close operations in San Francisco and Los Angeles. Ed Attorino is a media analyst with The Benchmark Company.
They're obviously trying to find a new market, a new way to make money.
Brad Adgate of Horizon Media says The Onion's likely TV viewers will be attractive to advertisers.
What's appealing about their audience is that it's young. It's very popular on college campuses. It's very popular with young adults.
So maybe it's no surprise that a recent headline on TheOnion.com says the Federal Communications Commission will be fining Americans who fail to keep up with television shows. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, researchers at Carnegie Mellon University say you can tell a lot about where a Twitter account is from according to its tweet. Those who studied hundreds of thousands of tweets concluded there are regional word and spelling differences in the Twitterverse. For example, and you might relate to this, if the word something is spelled Sutton, S-U-T-T-I-N, it's
Sutton.
Sutton. It's likely to have come from New York. Maybe you tweeted Sutton from New York there, Jeremy. I don't know. New Yorkers are also likely to use the letters O and D as a way to say very. I don't know what that means. Maybe you could figure that out.
I don't
out.
Either. What is O-D?
O-D. O-D. But in Northern California, here in my neck of the woods, a lot of Californians use the term hella. It's hella good, you know, and it replaces the word very. But I do have a question. When you see the word y'all, what region does that tweet come from?
Oh, I think that's from your home region.
Oh.
Or at least your former home.
Yeah, the South, Alabama, absolutely. Yeah. Right now, though, I'm in not in Alabama, A-L, I'm in L.A. Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
The exact reverse of Alabama.
That's
and
right.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.